think tomorrow we're obviously back in the same stages as we did in the first day, so I'm at less of a disadvantage. Whether I can be quicker than Carlos, I don't know, we'll wait and see.
And the last thing you need is a fight within your own team if you're going to keep Oriol behind. So our priority is to keep Oriol back and sort of not work together as a team, and that's going to be the instruction.
With only a 5-second deficit, difficult to do that, I would have thought.
They're professional drivers. They would end up going to the RAC rally on equal points, and that must be the sporting decision.
Colin, on paper, you've won this rally. Is that the situation?
Yeah, but we've had to book in a minute late now, so we're second.
So this was team categoric team orders?
Yeah, that's what it was. I don't agree with it, but that's the way it is. I won the rally. Why? We're fighting for the championship. Why should I have to finish second? Hey? I don't understand.
It's one of the penalties of being a professional driver, but, you know.
Yeah, okay, in certain situations, but we've got two drivers fighting for a championship. Equal chance of the championship. Yet I've got to slow down. I could have went to the RAC with 10 points advantage. Now I go equal. One problem in the RAC, I don't win the championship.
Okay, well, we're sorry that situation has occurred, but at least you've acted professionally.
Yeah. I had to.
There are other issues that come into this. We're running a team for Subaru to win the manufacturer's title, and it would be foolish to fight inside a team. And drivers reluctantly accept these situations because they're professionals, and inevitably there's there's discontent on occasions as a result of this. It's the reality of being in a professional team, I'm afraid.
The decision was made yesterday night, and at the very beginning I did not agree because I think it was not fair. But later on, David was again coming back and saying and explained that the manufacturer's title was very important for Subaru, and if we finished first and second, it was a good chance for Subaru to win, and that was the main reason. But I was not agreeing with the decision, and I was not asking for any decision like that at all.
But meanwhile, technical scrutiny is revealing serious irregularities with the Toyota team. Oriol's car is set for exclusion, and the team won't be contesting either the Network QRAC Rally or the 1996 World Championship as a result.
Hello and welcome to Episode 3, Series 2 of the Sprint Podcast. Once again, thank you all for tuning in for the previous episodes, both in this series and in Series 1. The last episode we went through the Celtic Tiger boom era in Irish rallying and all the madness that was surrounding that. We've got a great response to that, so, and some funny stories that came out again, so we might do a follow-up in the future, depending how strong our legal backing is, but sure, we'll figure it out. We also had a pretty cool event there recently. You might have checked it out on YouTube already if you haven't. Go ahead and do so, called Rally Amalgato, where we got a load of amalgamation cars together on some iconic Irish rallying roads. The video turned out really, really nicely, mainly because I wasn't actually involved in any of the production of it. We got an actual guy who knows what he's doing to look after that. Ross Delaney, he's a really, really, really talented videographer, so check that out. We also have a Speedrunners article going live on it as well. Should be up by now, with photos by Keane Donlan, Ross, and Rory Nash, and some words by myself, so do go and have a look at that. This episode we're going to look at the 1995 Rally Catalunya, quite a significant event in the championship that year for a number of reasons, and actually quite a significant event in the history of the sport as a whole. So Tommy is here again this evening.
Even Moss, I was farm, yeah, back by unpopular demand. The court order didn't hold up, so I'm allowed back on.
You're allowed back on. Good. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, the old restraining order, they're going to have to update the terms and conditions considering that it's over Zoom.
I'm above the law. I can buy my way out of anything now.
Good, good. Good to hear. Yeah, you can dig us out of all the holes we're creating with this Celtic Tiger talk anyway. So good man.
More diggers from the Celtic Tiger. More diggers.
Yeah. We don't have William. He might join us there in a while. Yet again, he's left us down in front of real people. But sure, this is the style of him. And we have Mark James joining us later on the episode for a segment on the rally as well. But anyway, yeah. So before we kick off with the look back at Catalonia, can we just point you towards the absolute rally specials on the 1995 season as a whole by Tony Simpson and the lads? They're fantastic. Make sure and check those out. I did check this for Tony that we were okay to do this before we went ahead. I did to be stepping on their toes. But if you have
this, what's known in the music industry is sampling.
Sampling, plagiarism. What I'm not sure what really you call it.
Inspired.
Maybe. Yeah, inspired by, as you'd see on like a food. Inspired by. Does Centra have inspired? No, we got to stop quoting these companies that aren't sponsoring us.
Yeah.
We I think we have a sponsorship coming up. We'll maybe reveal that in the next episode.
From Centra?
No. Something way, way less lucrative than that. But
do it some tinfoil around here.
Could you?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a shortage of it. Jeez, I tried to buy it during the week and fucking nowhere to be found. I don't know. What the fella is using it for? Is the question. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. so 1995. Kind of I suppose almost heading towards a transition into the World Rally Carrier from the Group A, but a lot of interesting aspects to the year as a whole. Few rule changes there at the start of the year. There was one of the big ones was the reduction in the turbo restrictor size, which was related to this event and what was to happen subsequently. But we'll get to that in due course. There was a lot of restrictions on servicing. So I think there was a lot of kind of onus put on the crews themselves to try and do some work on the cars in between stages, which wasn't popular among all. I know Delacour had a bit of an issue with it, didn't he?
Yeah, he was quite vocal about it in Monte Carlo. There's video footage if you look if you happen to get the season review, which is actually available if you have the ability of Indiana Jones to find it. It's in the WRC.com website.
Can we please request to whoever is behind that horrific library on WRC.com, just get your shit together. Thank you.
Yeah. Because it's letting it down. In fairness, the content is first class. It's just if you could actually access the content.
If you access the content and access the content consistently, because I don't think I've got into it the same way twice. But anyway. Look, it's there.
It's a bit like a nightclub, really. No one's got in or out of it the same way.
Yeah, we'd love to link it, but sure, there's no guarantee the link we send will work. And then you'd be giving us grief. And look, it's not our fault.
But he was there in Monty, and he was giving out about it. He had to change the brake discs or the brake pads, and seen him there with like a pliers removing studs. So, that was a restriction that had come in during the year. It wasn't popular with Delacour, and I can't imagine it was popular with many of the drivers.
I can see their point though. You know, it's not okay. You have to do a bit of running repairs here and there, but it is his point was correct. Like, it is difficult to drive a 40 kilometer stage or whatever flat out and then be expected to basically service the car afterwards. Like, it's over the course of 3 days or whatever. Now, Delacour does strike me as the kind of guy who would just round the bolt on purpose in order to not be asked to do it again. Like, but
I don't think he passed his apprenticeship anyway. Like,
I have fists of ham as well. When I generally tend to do more damage than good on the tools as well. But anyway, so we won't judge. The other significant thing was the rotation system for the rounds. Only 8 rounds in the year, and some classics were absent from the season. And were also 96. I think, was it meant to be every rally would run twice in a 3-year period or something? Was it along those lines?
Finland was absent anyway in 95.
Yeah.
And I think Rally Australia was absent as well.
No, Australia.
Oh, sorry. No, I'm thinking of 94, yeah. Actually. Fairly Australia was absent, but
was the rotation system running in 94?
Yeah, I think Sweden ran as a non-championship event for the world, the 2 liter 4 wheel drive cars.
Yeah,
because Thomas Rådström won the rally, and Australia in 94, McRae won it, but it wasn't. It was around the APRC.
Oh, okay.
So there was in 1994. I remember my mother bringing me back a rally magazine when I was a kid. What, and it had something in it about 1994. They were ruling. There was talk at the time that the 2 liter kit car or the 2 liter F2 category was going to become the top category. That was what they had. It was talks of back at that stage. So it could, there could be kind of some bit of a crossover between those rules and what were to become the World Rally Car rules in 1997.
Yeah.
But, that's why the sport evolved the way it did beyond this year of 1995 into, you've obviously 96 and then 97, the onset of the World Car rules.
Yeah. I just checked it out because
that I wasn't just making it up. You know,
in our usual, in our usual professional fashion, we've left the research to during and sometimes after we've recorded the relevant podcast. And 1994 was the beginning of the rotation system. There was 10 runs there, then there was 8 in 95. So we had the Monte. We actually had some Joe. There was a good share of classics, even though they'd lost some of the ones like Finland and San Remo and stuff. So you had the Monte, you had Sweden, Portugal, Corsica, New Zealand and Australia, Catalonia, and then the RAC to wrap things up. So, you know, not really sure how drivers and stuff felt about it. I know it obviously would have played in the team's hands because the costs were reduced and stuff like that, but it was an idea that kind of fell by the wayside. So by 1997, they went back up to whatever 14 runs again or whatever it was to be after that. So just giving a quick skim through the teams, starting off with Subaru, you had Carlos Sainz as the number one going into the season. Now, you know, it's worth looking back at the time and remembering how things were as well. I know we looked at 2001 in great detail, and Sainz was, you know, and probably still very, very competitive, but probably gone past the peak of his career. That's it. Sainz was probably the number one driver in the world at this time, or close to it, even though he hadn't won the championship for the previous couple of years, but he was always there or thereabouts.
With the exception of 93, really. Just a bad move, you know, that answer.
Yeah, he was just whatever driving force was behind that. But back into the Subaru for 94, and he was close enough to win the title in 94. Colin McRae then in the Subaru as well in his second season, I think, in the Works team. He'd had a bit of a strange one in 1994, lots of crashing and stuff like that. There was actually a good few drivers that were nominated during the year, although it was weird. The point system at the time meant that there was very little nomination of drivers needed. There was like, I think it was kind of an open season, so you could have as many cars entered for a particular manufacturer as you wanted, which led to weird situations like Group N cars scoring manufacturer points in some rounds and stuff like that.
Well, I think Ford had gone from running as a fully worked team out of Borum. They were being run by Rasport, the Belgian team.
Yeah.
Those of you who are European rally perverts will recognize the name from a certain Bastos liveried Escort Cosworth over the years. They used to run Patrick Snyers. So it had been outsourced, but there was still a lot of Borum input. But I think Ford in 94, I suppose we're here to talk about 95, but 95 comes after 94. That's basic mathematics. Ford, when Francois Delacorte broke his legs in the F40, there was certainly a loss of momentum in the team. And I think the focus just got shifted away from rallying there, if it was ever really there at all, you know, at a top boardroom level, because they didn't put the money behind it that potentially they should have done to take on Toyota and Subaru in the World Rally Championship.
But yeah,
like you could see that in 95, that they had fairly, they had a good team, but you know, they were rotating drivers all the time in the third car. You had Patrick Bernardini in the car in one rally, Alex Fiorio in at the next. Could be Franco Cunico or somebody in at the next day. You know,
pretty sure Stig Blomqvist did a rally with him as well, didn't he? I think. Yeah, but the Cosworth was a competitive car, as you said, probably suffered from a lack of funding. You know, the ultimate kind of factory support needed, even at the time, because you know you have to remember this is towards the tail end of the Group A era, and okay, Group A cars weren't as, you know, special in a way as the Group B cars, but they still cost a fortune to run, and teams, especially like the Lancia and Toyota, threw massive money at the support operations that they had. You know, there was just, this is when servicing was pretty much unrestricted. And, you know, the countless amounts of vans following the cars, their own chase cars, helicopters, planes even, you know.
So Ricky was fairly unrestricted too, as well.
I'd say some good stories from then. But anyway, so we kind of jumped from Subaru to Ford there. But just it's interesting to know for Subaru, you also had drivers like Pierre Oliati, Matt Johnson, Richard Burns, of course, the early stage of his career. And Passon Bourne as well would have joined for the Australasian runs as well. So, again, some household names. And this is the thing, you know, it's amazing to note around this era how many drivers were still competing. You know, the late 90s and early 2000s, the era of the sport when our interest really started growing it, you know. Then we had, I suppose, with four factory teams entering full Group A cars, if you want to call them that. For the championship. So the third we can say is Mitsubishi. They went in with the Evo 2 to start the year, switched to the Evo 3 for Corsica, I think. Fantastic cars, actually. Jeez, I love the early Lancers. They were fantastic looking and sounding car, and they definitely sounded as if they had the strongest engine out of all of the cars there. But anyway,
there's a great video actually for anyone who's looking to throw something up in their Chromecast this evening. If you can get 1993 Monte Carlo Rally pure engine sounds, Armin Schwartz in what would have been probably the Evo 1, would I be right in saying that?
It would have been.
And it's just,
yeah, it's fair. Some power there, like, yeah,
it's just raw.
We're talking,
I think, 38 or 40 mil restrictors even at that stage, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Every just, year it came down by 2 mil or something. It was ridiculous.
Like just power. It's raw power.
Yeah.
But in the team that year, we had Kenneth Eriksson, talkative, friendly Swede. We had Ty Mäkinen, again, in his kind of early days, but was starting to show signs of ominous pace, I suppose you could say, for the rest of the 90s. Andrea Ghini was in the car for a couple of rounds. And we have, among others, Rui Madeira in Group N cars, Isalda Holderoid, famous lady, German driver. And for fans of Conor McRae 2, Kenneth Backlund. And I do believe there's a Kay Backlund in Conor McRae 2 as one of the AIA drivers, is there?
Conor McRae 1.
Is it one,
where,
was it?
Where Sorry. He was in the Evo 4 and Richard Burns is in the other Evo 4.
Was that it?
Okay. Yeah.
Very good. I didn't realize that. But there he is anyway. Yeah, Kenneth Backlund. Famous. I have him up here in front of me and you can't even click into his name to see it at the bottom because I'm ashamed to say I have Wikipedia open as one tab on the 95 season, but EWRC, well, it's fantastic. It sometimes does not have the easiest interface for looking at teams and stuff. So Kenneth Backlund has no entry on Wikipedia. That's kind of sad. Maybe we'll create one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And then we're on to Toyota. Ooh, boo. Ooh, yes, boo. So Toyota, they brought in the ST205 towards the tail end of 94. I think Kankin had it out for a couple of events. We're having some difficulties with the car. I do believe the front suspension was quite challenging on it. I'm not sure where the Wox cars are running the Super Strut setup. I know that there was I think Bosch types of the standard MacRussell and the Super Strut were homologated, but I think the Super Strut was particularly troublesome on gravel rallies. Just there's a crazy amount of bearings and stuff going on in it, so it's quite hard to maintain. Apparently gave good traction, but again, not the easiest thing.
It's always struck me as a very wide car. for some of the more narrow stages compared to the ST185. Now, granted, I'd say if you put the two on the side by side, it's probably nothing. It's probably just a very imposing looking car with the front of it.
Yeah, I like the 205, especially on tarmac. I think they had presence. And we had Lee McCallan had a gorgeous one over here, we mentioned in the European episode. The SO called us, just really nice car. But they always look good. There's actually a very interesting video from 94 Finland testing, where I think it's Juha is driving the ST185 and the 205 back to back. And if you just hear the two cars, oh my God, there are some power. I'd say if they're under 400 horsepower, I'd be surprised. They are animals of the ox, even on the gravel, like the fucking acceleration and the noise off them is crazy. But anyway, check that out if you can dig it out on YouTube. So, yeah, again, that had different drivers, but the main squad was Didier Aurel, 1994 world champion. As we mentioned previously, no man has ever driven as badly to clinch a world title, but he got it. Fair play to him. Juha Kankkonen, at that point, a four-time world champion and arguably the sport's most successful driver. Still very much at the peak of his powers, very, very fast on gravel. And would subsequently prove to be very, very fast on tarmac for one event. Why would that be now? Bald. Aaron Schwartz, I've been kind of knocking on with Toyotas a couple of years at that stage. Did a lot of crashing. Was very quick in his day, but Aaron was always more of a kind of a very quick European level driver as opposed to a top class world driver, but still good to see him out and trying Toyotas around. They use a variety of other local specialists and Japanese guys in as well. So you have Thomas Radstrom, Thomas Jansson, two Swedish guys, and then Yoshio Fujimoto in for the Australasian runs as well, and Neil Bates, Australian, kind of a very quick local guy over there. So yeah, that's the summary of where we were going into Catalonia the season. So if you look at just basically going into Catalonia, how things had worked out, the championship standings going in were interesting enough, and there'd been some, I suppose, despite the fact there was, you know, small enough, there was a small amount of rounds, it was still quite an interesting championship.
Yeah, when you look at it, it was actually very tight coming out of Australia going into Rally Catalonia. Juha Kankkonen leading the series on 62 points, with Colin McRae lying second on 55, with Didier Auriel third on 51 points, Carlos Sainz just a further point behind on 50, and Ericsson lying fifth on 48. But that's not the whole story, because obviously Carlos went missing in New Zealand. He wasn't available to do the event.
Yeah, he had what was what was announced at the time as a fall from his mountain bike, but I think in subsequent years it was proven to be a mountain bike with an engine. So draw your own conclusions there. But I don't think I didn't want the PR getting out at the time. But he had a nasty enough injury and apparently took a fair bit of training on his side. But again, like, if there was anyone that's going to come back from an injury like that, it's Carlos. You know, the man's a machine. Like,
yeah, he was there in Australia. Like, you know, he only missed one event, to be fair to him. Like, and he was, I don't know how much of it was playing up to the cameras. He was there saying, it's only a problem if I'm going playing tennis, going rallying shouldn't be an issue at all.
Yeah. Like,
you'd be kind of thinking to yourself, you know, your shoulder has been fairly badly fractured, I'd say, after coming off the bicycle.
Yeah.
Inverted commas for that one. But no, at the same time, Australia, the two Australasian rounds proved crucial, because at mid-season, McRae wasn't even in the top five of the championship. Like, Colin had a fairly... a mixed first half of the year.
It was shite.
Well, the first rally, what was it? He got cut out with the gravel, with the ice note crew, where it was black ice where the black tracks were.
Yeah.
Went off the road. Second rally, the engine detonated in Sweden.
I think all of the Subaru suffered in Sweden, didn't they?
Yeah. And it's probably something quite ominous in this. I think in Portugal and Corsica, they were talking about it. They were Subaru were complaining that they were down on power compared to their rivals. So, yeah, you'd wonder, was there the murmurings beginning of...
And our, again, with hindsight, as Mac alluded to when we talked to him, as you'll hear later on in the episode, you know, it's easy to look back now and we can say that, yeah, Jesus, that car sounded quick or whatever. But yeah, when you do look at it like that, it is kind of, it's weird to see, like, isn't it? And Ariel did actually win.
With a substitute navigator. Dennis Giraudet, I don't think Dennis even got to do the recce. Bernard Acelli had to go at the last minute.
Right.
And Dennis Giraudet was the sub in. But like when you looked at, though, at mid-season, you wouldn't have put your money on Colin McRae being in the fight. But then again, there was that many points on offer for each event that, you know, you could probably get in there, you know, with the bit of attrition in an event.
Yeah, I think probably at that point in the season, before Carlos had his accident on the bike, the team was probably fully of that opinion as well, that Carlos was the best hope. He definitely, like, he had two victories. He'd won in Monte in Portugal. He'd got strong points in Corsica as well. So, you know, he was probably the strongest hope for them. But again, Colin had that spectacular run in New Zealand. Took something like, was it 46 seconds out of everyone on Moto Road? Again,
yeah, you know,
it's just it's like, I'd love to have seen an onboard from that.
But like McRae, I suppose he was showing you know, flashes of his pace the last year and a half, I suppose, to that point, because I think he was fairly close to, there was talks in 94. By all accounts, if you read back on these things, that he'd been doing quite a bit of damage and it wasn't going down well at Subaru. And in the second half of 94, he started getting a few wins and, you know, things seemed to rectify themselves. But the wildness was still there, because if you actually watch the Australian footage, he has a narrow escape at a tree close to the road. He actually hits it because the intercom isn't working right. Now, look, we're not Colin McRae or Carlos Sainz. We're not at that level where you're fighting for tooth and nail for tenths of seconds. But, you know, risk management at that end of the year, you'd be kind of saying, yeah, the intercom's not working right. We'll bring it down 5% here, but I suppose that's a touch of what made Colin McRae as well.
Yeah.
Luckily, he got away with it for this year.
Whenever he finished, right, he finished 6 rallies out of the 8. And he was only, of those 6, he was only off the podium once. So when he did get to the end, he was generally, you know, doing good. He had 2 wins over the course of the year, 3 technically on the road, as we'll find out. But, you know, it was actually a really good drive by him in the latter half of the season. He did everything he probably could have done, you know. But yeah, so that's where we were heading into Catalonia. I guess, you know, it was set up at the time that the Toyotas were still in with a shout as well. What was the points difference over the top 3?
The top 3 were covered by 11 points. Juha Kankinen was on 62. Colin McRae was on 55 with Didier Auriol on 51.
Yeah.
But Sainz was only a point behind that again on 50.
Yeah.
Kenneth Eriksson was on 48, but he wouldn't be starting, which we'll find out more about now in a few minutes.
Yeah. So yeah, quite interesting. And Catalonia, as we covered in our 2001 review, kind of a classic European round, and was well established as well at that point. Your lovely tarmac stages there, not far from Barcelona. Huge passion at home, huge passion for signs. You know, as I said, he'd already won the championship twice at that stage. But yeah, so I know it's over to Tommy with the sports desk with Tommy's entry list deep dive.
And it's a special entry list deep dive tonight, guys, as we look back at the Rally Catalonia 1995. So sit back, relax, lie down, and let the deep dive commence. So an all tarmac rally had been a mixed surface event until 1993, This year's events consist of 23 stages with 474.35 kilometres. 81 entries comprise the event with 18 Group A, 8 cars and 8 N4 cars. Not a wild number of entrants in that at the time, but there was 4 works teams. And when it comes to works teams, you can't say fairer than Toyota Team Europe. 3 cars for Juha Kankinen, Didier Auriol and Armin Schwartz. Subaru entered 3 cars, 2 for the usual suspects, Colin McRae and Carlos Sainz, with the 3rd car entered for Pierre Liatti, who was actually joined on the entry by his close friend and rival, Andrea Navarra, who was in Mitsubishi, joining Tommy Mäkinen in the Evo 3 that the two of them had been working hard on developing. Ford had entered 2 cars only, one for François Delacour, who'd won the rally back in 1993, and one for Bruno Thierry, who had been hoping for better luck than what he'd encountered in Corsica earlier in the year. Private cars of note were Gustavo Treves and Andrea Navarra were both out in Toyota Sedica GT4s. Treves was in SC205 and Navarra was in a Grifone run Sedica. I think Navarra's car was a 185. I stand to be corrected on that one. There was 2 Lancia Deltas entered for a couple of local guys. Interesting car also for Pep Bassas in a BMW M3, which I'm guessing was probably they'd got tipexed to the homologation papers at that stage and stretched it out to the last.
Stretched out, yeah.
I'd
yeah.
say the homologation papers are made of elastic at that stage. And Jorge, another interesting entry in the rally as well was actually for Jorge Recalde, the ex-Lancia works driver. He was out in a Group N Evo, but he was not nominated for works points because in the Mitsubishi team, along with Andrea Ghini and Tommy Mäkinen, Rui Madeira, the Portuguese Group N driver, he was nominated to score manufacturer points if he came near the top 10 or something, that he'd get them. Anyone who was a fan of front-wheel drive cars, though, would have been very well served, because lots of local and national interest there. Jesus Puras at number 18 was also followed by his good friend and close rival, Aurel Gomez, in the works Clio, run from the Renault Spain sports network. And the rest of the entry, I suppose, was populated by a number of Clios, Ibizas, Peugeot 106s, 205s. There was one Uno Turbo, which for some reason, now someone can explain it to us, was entered in Class 8, but it's probably something to do with the multiplication factor for turbocharging.
Something to do with engine. Forced induction cars having to have run into the big classes. Yeah, God love them. Probably overheated not long after the start ramp anyway. But look,
overheated beautifully though. I'd say.
With
style,
with flair,
anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a Corolla GTI and one brave UK crew went in a Skoda Favorite.
Very good. Very good. That has been Tommy's interlist deep dive. Join him.
Join me.
Right. Let's move on to more serious matters. And Mark James, who was actually
later at the event. I'll have Sandy Lyle on the line.
Yeah. Mark James, who was actually at the event, is going to talk us through. So here we go.
You have to realize that, you know, we headed to Catalonia with 4 teams. Off the top of my head, we had 2 Fords, 2 Mitsubishis, 3 Subarus, 3 Toyotas, plus then you also had the privateers and you had the Group N cars and the like. And it just didn't seem odd, you know. One of the Fords, I think it was Thierry, had a brake problem, I think.
There was a problem with a batch of hubs, I think, from Bornholm.
It was a hub. There we are. Yeah, early on then. So it was Thierry, wasn't it, that had the problem?
Yeah.
And the other car would have been Delacour. So they were worried that was going to happen as well to him. There were stories during the first couple of days. I think Mäkinen had a problem in the Mitsubishi. So it was kind of business as usual. And of course, then on the final day, or in fact, the night before the final day, you had the business with the Subaru team orders, which threw me, to put it mildly. And I just thought, because it was my first year and, you know, 1995 was going so well. And we were all invited to this cozy dinner by David Richards, during which he said, you know, we've made the decision, Carlos is going to win. Oh, really? And out came the notebooks. So then it was, all right, this isn't how it's done then. This is quite unusual. And it was Martin Holmes, bless him, who obviously passed away earlier on this year. It was Martin who kind of went, this is big news. You know, this doesn't normally happen. And the fact that they've declared it so publicly that this is what they're going to do, and Carlos is going to win his home event, and Colin's going to come second, and they're going to hold station. And of course, as we now know, that's not kind of how the script played out.
Yeah. Was that, do you reckon that was, look, obviously, DR had, you know, Subaru's manufacturer's title at the forefront of his mind. Was it also sort of a thing to not, you know, upset the Spanish, the home crowd in a way, and potentially have Sainz losing the event? Do you think there was a little bit of that as well?
Well, from memory, Sainz hadn't actually won any events that year, because it was mainly, I think Colin had won in New Zealand.
So Carlos had won in Monte and Portugal, I think, and then he went out, he fell off his
mountain bike. Ah, that's right. Sorry, yeah,
I think it was a mechanically propelled mountain bike. It was later came out that it wasn't quite as it wasn't as small an accident as he might have made it out to be to Pro Drive. So
yeah, and there was something similar a few years later where he'd had an injury and kind of played it down. And we actually interviewed him at Cardiff Airport, of all places. He'd come over for Rally GB, and he was clearly in discomfort. And he said, look, guys, can you kind of not make a big deal of this? Because he said, I really don't want it known that I'm struggling. And we went, yeah, that's fine. So, yeah. You know, he and let's face it, you know, the number of drivers who've done things like fallen off bikes or motorbikes or done silly things over the years, you know, we could probably do a podcast about that, but yeah. But no, in 95, kind of DR had almost an embarrassment of riches. You know, he had two drivers capable of winning the driver's title. He had the likes of Liatti there as the kind of the dependable other driver to pick up points if either Carlos or Colin retired. So they were in a strong position, but they didn't actually lead going into the final round, which was Rally GB. I think it was it something to do with a Group N car, from memory, that Mitsubishi, when Toyota was excluded, one of the Mitsubishis, the Group N Mitsubishis, moved up, and that meant that Mitsubishi actually led going into Rally GB. So it was, you know, all of this is going on in the back of DR's mind. And of course, what he didn't want is for Carlos or Colin or both potentially to throw it off the road while they were battling together. So you can kind of see team orders has always been a situation that's been slightly kind of uncomfortable with me, because it's always been kind of artificially managed. But, you know, ultimately you've got multi-million pounds car companies, cigarette companies, oil companies, tire companies, all wanting their brand across the line. And sometimes, you know, the team principals have to make decisions that the rest of us go, oh, come on, let them fight. But kind of you can have some sympathy with DR to say, you know, if he hadn't done it, particularly the way that Colin was driving, you know, they might have had no cars at the finish, or Liatti could have won it or something, you know.
Absolutely. Like, and the point you mentioned there about a Group N Mitsubishi, I think it was actually Rui Madeira, a Portuguese driver, was the guy. And you, as you mentioned, the Toyota, RLC, yes, Toyota being excluded. Like, that was just another interesting anomaly from the time that Group N cars, while, you know, they were obviously wouldn't have been fighting for overall victory at the time, they could still score manufacturer points,
yeah, because you didn't have to nominate.
Exactly. It was really, yeah, it was. So you had a really strange situation where, I think, did Renault even score? Do you know, it's just weird kind of stuff like that, where just by dint of having a large amount of one particular brand in a rally, they come away with a lot of manufacturer points. It was strange, wasn't
it? That final day was so bizarre that it was only, I think, kind of coming back to the UK and doing the prep work for Rally GB. And of course, all the focus was on Colin. And it's actually, oh, hang on, Mitsubishi are leading. How did that happen? But, you know, obviously, as we know, with hindsight, that didn't have a bearing on the final result. But it certainly threw the Subaru plans kind of up in the air, because they thought that they would be coming to the UK either jointly or in overall lead of the manufacturers as well. So, you know, they thought, oh, we're going to clean up here. We're going to take both titles. And actually they were not as well off as they thought in the teams battle, which in many ways for the Japanese would have perhaps been of more PR value, because they were beating two other Japanese brands, Mitsubishi and Toyota.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, just the weekend, it wasn't actually a weekend as we discovered when we did our research. It was Monday to Wednesday, wasn't it? It was kind of, again, just a kind of a relic of a time. That's something that's obviously gone by the wayside with TV schedules and things like that these days. But I know, obviously covering the event as media, did you actually get to see much of the stages themselves? And could you tell that there was something funny happening with the Toyotas? Was it visibly evident or anything?
No, that was all with hindsight. And bizarrely, afterwards, of course, you then thought, oh, hang on, Kankanen was really quick in Australia. And it's only afterwards that you put these things together. Kankanen, always happier on gravel than he was on tarmac, suddenly to be leading the rally by a good old chunk when he put it off the road. You talk to the teams, you talk to the crews these days, and they will tell you that they had no idea. But for the car to be that much quicker, they must have had an inkling that something was going on. To answer your question, I was actually, I won't say stuck, but I was at Rally HQ. The first year that I did the championship was for radio, only radio. I was working for a chap called Greg Strange, who you may have come across, again, sadly, no longer with us. But Greg, I'd left the BBC at the end of 94, gone freelance, and Greg had come in and said, I'd done some work for Greg, and he said, do you think rallying would work on radio? And I said, yeah, I think it would, actually. And he said, good, that's what I've told them. So we're off to Monte Carlo in a week's time. And he'd been contracted by a body called the World Rally Teams Association to raise the profile, if you like, of rallying. So we were doing, we started off, the pair of us, going to a couple of events, and then the budget was such that it was only me that did the entire year. But I went to Kenya, to New Zealand, to Australia, you know, over the space of the year. And it was amazing. It was fantastic. It was, you know, me pinching myself on a regular basis, doing the covering the sport I loved. It then went on. Greg and I parted company at the end of the year. I ended up doing radio and TV. But that first year, I was at Rally HQ doing kind of hourly or even half hourly reports for a range of radio stations, you know, trying to get the profile up. And of course, by that time of the year, it looked like Colin was in with a shout of the championship. So the interest from UK radio was probably the highest we'd had. So I was just flat out doing radio bulletins and relaying the stories as they were coming in. And of course, not being out on the stages, not knowing what was going on right until the end, it was the only story I was able to put across was the whole business about team orders on the final day.
That's it's interesting when you say that people, you know, with hindsight now, obviously it's easy to say or to imagine maybe that, oh, that car definitely sounds like it was up on power compared to earlier in the year. And maybe I think I'm guilty of convincing myself and probably many others that when you look at the footage, you know, and you think, oh yeah, that's definitely something up there. But as you said, you know, it's amazing that it wasn't more apparent. I know, you know, it was mentioned in the podcast you did with the guys at Absolute Rally as well about the start in Langley Park in Australia,
yeah,
and the car pulling the Celica pulling a couple of car lengths and the Impreza and DR not being happy with David Laporte initially thinking that the engine was in trouble in the Subaru or whatever. But yeah, it's amazing. But I suppose, like, okay, the event was going pretty, you know, routinely, if you want to say that, for the first day or two. Whenever things started to break on Saturday night, obviously, you know, there was probably talk at the time around Toyota, you know, that their turbos and stuff had been seized. Was there much kind of discussion going on around then?
No, because they were down to one car by then, because Armin Schwarz had, I think he was quickest very early on. And then Kankanen, as I said, really kind of moved up a gear and was leading. Both of them retired. Armin, I think, was technical, and Juha and Nicky Grist had a big accident, ended up sort of in a ditch somewhere and had to, I think, kick the windscreen out to get out the car. So it was only Didier Auriol who finished the rally. But the FIA had already impounded the turbos on both Schwarz and Kankanen's car. And the rumor subsequently was that there was a whistleblower who'd gone to the FIA, possibly, you know, disgruntled ex-employee or whatever it was, and had said roughly what was going on. And I think I said to you this before when we did the piece a couple of months ago, that the technical delegate of the FIA, a guy called Jacques Berger, was looking for the tool. And they were so blatant that nobody knew what they were up to, that this tool of springing the clips back to actually reset it was hanging on the back door of the van. I don't remember, I'm not sure if you know the full kind of workings of this beautifully engineered sort of cheat device, but if you tried to unclip the pipework that led to it, it would spring back, and it was all beautifully machined and you couldn't tell. So they had to use this tool, a bar kind of device, to set it and then clip the pipework in place. And it was that bar that they discovered, and that's when, right, we're having that turbocharger. And I think that's when it dawned on the senior management that I think the game's up here, which is why as soon as the rally finished they were off to the airport.
Whoa, yeah, bit of an escape. I know Nicky Grist told the story about Dieter Bulling, one of the TT engineers. I know, was he the chief engineer of TT or one of the chief engine guys? I'm not sure.
I think he was the guy that took the fall for it, wasn't he?
I think so, yeah. There was a lot of kind of talk about that. Like, you know, that he was, I suppose someone, did, like anything, they'll always want to pinpoint it on someone, but he was chain-smoking. before the news fully came out or whatever, but yeah, mad stuff. Like,
thanks, Mark. I suppose much has been made in the last decade or more of Colin's rebellious final day, but I suppose there is coverage out there to suggest that on the night before, that on the surface he was cooperating on the surface with DR's team orders for Carlos and him to hold station.
Yeah, I think, Tommy, the reasoning that Colin came up with, and it's not an unreasonable one, is that he couldn't afford to back off, because when you back off, that's when your mistakes happen. And Carlos might have been happy at 90%. I mean, they still had Auriol to contend with. They didn't know at that point that the Toyotas were going to get kicked out. So they were something like first, second and fourth at that point. And Auriol was third, not that far behind Colin. So he still had to up his game. And he was, you know, he was adamant that, you know, there was no point in completely backing off. And so Carlos drove at 90%. Colin was at 100%, as he liked to do. But it was that the defining moment for me is that onboard shot of them crossing the line of the final stage, where even at the flying finish, you've got the Pro Drive senior management. So you've got John Spiller, I think David Lapworth was there, Nigel Riddle was there, and they're the ones who were looking anxiously at their watches, and they're trying to flag Colin down. And I think Colin changes up as he goes past them. And this is, you know, 100 meters before the flying finish. So this was the last opportunity that they had to make him slow in order for Carlos to win. Because I think the winning margin in the end wasn't that great. It was only something like 9 or 10 seconds, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 9 seconds. Carlos had kind of an 8 or 9 second lead going into the final day. Colin turned that around, and I think was it, 9 seconds was his winning margin on the road, we'll say.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have taken much for him to have just pulled over, sat there, and then, you know, drove over the flying finish line. But of course, the way it happened, Carlos being a very, very proud man, at home in Catalonia, he'd been shown up. He'd been told by his team management that something was going to happen, and it didn't happen the way he was told. So he was unhappy. I think he'd already announced at that point that he was going to leave Subaru anyway. I think he was originally planning to go to Toyota, of all places.
He was, yeah. So, that was the original plan.
Yeah, so it was all a real kind of mishmash. And then you saw the whole business at the end with kicking the rubbish bin and everything else. And the way that it was managed was that he took a 1 minute penalty. Sorry, he took a 10 second penalty, a 1 minute early check-in, which gets you, you know, 10 seconds, which was just enough to let Carlos sneak ahead. So it was, I think the outcome in the end didn't really please everybody, please anybody for that matter. But you could see that Colin was trying to make a point and Carlos played by the rules. So it's kind of, you know, as I said earlier, you know, you can argue against team orders, but actually kind of Carlos played it by the book and Colin was the rebellious, you know, no, I'm going to do it my way. And it all got very public and the way that the penalty was managed in the end was, you know, I don't think anybody at ProDrive particularly wanted it to happen like that. I think that Colin was really misunderstood. I think a lot of people had Colin as the dour Scot and the you know, arrogance and all this kind of thing. He wasn't. He was actually quite a shy character. His father, who I've got immense respect for, I've interviewed Jimmy I don't know how many times. And whatever you do, guys, if you ever interview Jimmy, don't get the number of British titles that he won wrong, because I did it once and I don't think he's ever forgiven me. But the family, you know, Jimmy dealt with the British press, the motorsport press was always, you know, so why aren't you world champion? You know, and why haven't you won the rally? And Jimmy said to me, you know, years later, you have to remember that we were up against the best in the world who were driving these cars kind of every other week and practicing and testing and whatever. And we got one event a year. Yes, it was the British Forests, but these guys were so quick, you know, we're never going to beat them. And so he was always kind of on the back foot with the media. And I think that's a message he gave Colin quite early on. And so Colin came across as quite shy, but I think he just didn't enjoy talking to the media. Unless he knew kind of he could trust you, you know, and he knew that you weren't going to, you know, you weren't going to throw him to the wolves kind of thing. I think, you know, hopefully I'd look back at it and say we had a pretty good relationship. Although for a year, I think, yeah, just over a year, I think virtually every conversation I had with Colin started with the question, so what happened? You know, there was that dreadful period at Ford where he just retired event after event, and most of it, you know, they weren't big accidents. They were the odd one or two, but, you know, it was mechanical. And in the end, you know, the classic line about ask the Welsh wizard, because Colin was just fed up making excuses. But he didn't like that, and he didn't enjoy the media bit. And that meant that he sometimes came across to people who didn't know him as, you know, arrogant, aloof, shy, whatever it was.
After the team order debacle and kind of, you know, I wouldn't say the dust had settled, what was the atmosphere like around the service park or the HQ when the Pro Drive decision had been made? Was there kind of a sense of there's a bit of conflict going on here, or was it?
Well, we thought, I mean, and remember, 95, as I was saying earlier, was my first year doing the championship. So when we were invited out to dinner by DR on the penultimate night, and told, you know, we've had a meeting and we've agreed Carlos is going to win, Colin's going to come second, they're going to hold station. So this is how it works at world championship level. And it was only looking around at the likes of, you know, Martin Holmes and David Williams, another character who's not with us and no longer with us, you know, and their reaction. It's like, oh, this isn't how it happens. And so when I was doing radio stuff the following day, it was, you know, Colin McRae still second, but remember, folks, he is going to finish second. And so you've got that awful moment where you've been telling radio audiences all day that Carlos is going to win this, and Colin blitzes the last stage and crosses the line first. So there was a kind of what is going on kind of mood. And then we were told by the Subaru PR people, no, it's going to be managed. We told Carlos, this is what's going to happen. And so it was only afterwards that I saw the TV pictures of, you know, the meeting in the motorhome and Colin sat slumped inside and then he comes out and kicks over the bin and everything else. And then obviously they said, look, you know, there is one final place where he could take a penalty, which is arriving at the final final main control, which is what happened. So thanks to all of that, I was hopefully able to convey to the radio audience that, okay, Collins won, but it's likely that he's going to be told to take a penalty by the team. And so what I've been telling you all day is going to happen. And subsequently, that's exactly what happened. Carlos wins, Colin comes second, Didier comes third. And then, whoa, hold on a second. There's another story breaking. So just as the dust, as you say, was starting to settle on what we thought was the big story, which was the Subaru team orders debacle, the Toyota business started kicking off.
I think you mentioned Jimmy there, Mark there a couple of minutes ago. I think Jimmy, going by Colin's autobiography anyway, had a big part to play in probably talking him into taking that penalty. I think maybe reading between the lines from DR, if you don't, you might win this rally, but you might not have a car for GB if you don't take the penalty. I don't know, was there much truth to that, but I imagine it was pretty tense at the time. So yeah, with this subsequent story breaking then, you know, what was your initial, I suppose, you know, exposure to it? Where did you get the news from?
Well, again, I was sat at Rally HQ. The rally was over. We had a result. And then suddenly somebody said the Toyotas have been impounded. Because, of course, you don't know at the time what's happening, because it has to go to the stewards. The stewards make a decision. They meet after the rally. So I'm pretty sure that I traveled home from Catalonia with the last piece I did was that, you know, the Subarus are 1, 2, and 3, but the Toyota, which had finished third, has been withdrawn or suspended or whatever the phrase was, pending some kind of decision by the stewards on a technical matter. And I'm pretty sure I flew home on the night after the finish. So it was only when we got home, and it then went to the FIA fairly quickly, I think either the following week or the week after, and the FIA, who obviously had the full facts, and they'd got the turbos and they'd stripped them down and they'd found the cheat device, not only did they kick them out, but they gave them a 12-month ban and also stripped all their points for the year. So they'd effectively got a 2-year ban. So they were kicked out of 95 and they were kicked out of 96. And ultimately, as you know, they came back with the Corolla. But it was, you know, for a Japanese team, albeit one that was run out of Cologne in Germany by Uwe Andersen and the team, Toyota Team Europe, it was a very embarrassing, you know, with the Japanese culture of honor and pride and all of this sort of thing, you can't even begin to think how the story would have gone down back in Japan.
I suppose the precedent to the only event that had something similar that happened was in 86 with Lancia and Peugeot on the side skirts issue
in
Sanremo. But with the controversy of Catalonia and how it had unfolded on the final night and subsequently the final afternoon, how much did that, I suppose, help in growing the fever for Rally, the Network Q, the RAC, with the two guys going head to head and the controversy over team orders?
I think the fact that it was run the way around that it was obviously benefited Colin, because he came to his home event at the end of the season. So it was the kind of surface that he'd grown up on, and the fans, as I said earlier, probably worth an extra 10%. And looking at the onboard back from 95, the number of people that were in the forests and the air horns and the flags and everything else just lifted Colin. And, you know, Carlos was I won't say a broken man, but he knew that he had not only Colin, but, you know, he had the Welsh forests and the fans to beat as well. And it ended, I think, the right way. And we kind of the business in Catalonia was not quite forgotten, because here we are 25 years later still talking about it. But if it had gone the other way, if Rally GB hadn't been the last round, and either it had been Catalonia or indeed Argentina, which was the last round, would we have had the same result? I wonder.
Good point. Yeah, it's something, again, with the whole rotation system at the time, you know, which was very, very strange. I don't know if anyone was too happy with it.
The teams were, because obviously it reduced costs. But, you know, if you were a marketing person and you were trying to tell the story of this amazing series that was heading off around the world, and it was tackling some of the toughest terrain in the world, and it was, you know, snow in Sweden and ice in Monte Carlo, and the, you know, the savannah in Kenya, and these amazing switchback roads in New Zealand. Ah, but not every year. We'll only do them 2 out of 3, and then the other year it'll kind of not be a round of the championship, but it'll still carry on. So it was all a bit, you know, it was kind of a, really? So the fact that, you know, when it went back up to 13, 14, 15 rounds, whatever it was, when it kind of all ended, at least you knew then that it was the full world championship. And they still tried to cut costs. You know, they arranged the shipping so that the long haul kit could leave the UK sort of early in the new year, and we would first see it in Kenya. Then it would head off down to probably Argentina, and then it would be shipped across to New Zealand, and then finally Australia. And then it would make its way back to the UK to be checked, stripped, rebuilt, sort of, you know, December, January time, and then off it would go again. So you had these very small vans that would fit into shipping containers, which were nicknamed the ice cream vans, or the burger vans, I think they used to call them. And then they used to hire local trucks, support vehicles or whatever, in whichever country we were in. And obviously some, New Zealand, Australia, were great. And then in places like Kenya, you had these massive, great trucks driven by locals that had seen better days. So they were kind of tucked around the back of the service park, and you had the branded burger vans, ice cream vans at the front to kind of show the branding off to the... Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose... This year, the 95 season, you know, obviously the guys with an absolute rally have covered it in really good detail. Mm. And so just check those episodes out if you haven't done so already. They're cracking. But just, I suppose, to kind of get, did you sense, again, you said it was your first year, you know, covering the sport at world level. Did you feel that the sport, obviously with at home, Colin's profile was growing and that was helping. How did you feel that the sport presented itself at the time? You know, and when you had these kind of controversies happening, did you think that it was, you know, maybe going down a bad road?
No, I don't think so. I think it got column inches, which is what the sport badly needed. It still does. You know, you had Rally GB, the RAC, the Network Q, whatever you want to call it. They used to trot out this figure of 2 million spectators or whatever, but I can believe it, because when I started spectating on events in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, you'd have the Sunday run, which would be through the stately homes, and the crowds were massive. It's hard to get across how many people would be packed into, you know, Longleat or Chatsworth or whatever to see the cars. And then every roundabout, every bridge over the road would have somebody on it waving just to see the cars driving on road sections. And of course, you just don't get that these days. And with so much else in terms of sport, motorsport, you know, it is difficult to try and get across an event that takes 3 days. It's a bit like cricket. You know, they had to kind of invent 2020 or the short form of the game to kind of attract a new audience, because the older audience was drifting away. And it's possibly a bit like that with rallying. But in the 90s, you know, you still had the big crowds, and McRae was a household name. And a couple of years later, with the video game and everything else, and Subaru, you know, basing a marketing campaign around blue Imprezas with gold wheels, everybody wanted to be Colin McRae. And ultimately, of course, he was followed by Richard Burns, more of the same.
Absolutely, yeah. I think just that on the Toyota element, so as we've discussed, they had a ban for 96. Now the cars did turn up to various events run under satellite teams as such, but they were, you know, they were still work specification cars. And they came back in with the Corolla kind of halfway through 97, leading into 98, the full assault of 98 again. When Toyota returned, I guess, what was the mood around the place? Were people viewing them, you know, as fraudsters or cheats, or was it just kind of, oh, you guys got caught, tough luck, you know, whatever else was, you know, added? We've all heard the various stories from the service parks that people just didn't get caught out with. But was it, were they kind of shunned in a way in the service parks?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I had friends, or I made friends with some of the people who worked for Toyota, and they were genuinely kind of remorseful for what had happened. And yes, they were caught. Yes, they served their punishment. Maybe we'll never get to the bottom of the story as to who knew or how far up the food chain it went. Because a lot of the people who were high up on that food chain just aren't with us anymore. But you know, the relaunched, revamped team, when it appeared, you know, hit the ground running in Finland. I remember seeing the Corolla kind of on the start ramp, and then, you know, they went looking for young talent. I remember a very drunk Marcus Gronholm in the disco at the Rantasippi Hotel on the last night of Finland, basically telling anyone who'd listen that he just had a phone call from Uwe Andersson and he wanted to chat about him driving for the following year. You know, they were back with a bang, and I think people were prepared to say, okay, you got caught, you tried, you got caught, you've served your punishment, now you're back.
So, Tammy, what were your thoughts on the whole Toyota scandal, first of all?
I suppose, really, when you think about it, they were the ones that got caught. There's several stories of lots of different interpretations of the rules back in the 90s. Like, I think there was a McLean or a book out, the Group A book, and it became known as the cheating era because they were so restricted in the 90s of what they could do, that they were all trying to find their own ways. And everyone's heard the stories of the really heavy spare wheels and the guys with radiation suits refueling the car, things like that. You know, it's a bit...
I think we'll probably do a separate episode on some of those kind of stories, incorporating the Toyota cheat in a future series. But, like, do you think that the punishment was fair, or do you think it was too harsh or too lenient by the FIA?
See, the problem was, because it was such a clever cheat and it was so well concealed, and they had discovered it with one round of the season to go, if they had discovered it, say around Rally Sweden time, if it had become known at that stage, they probably could have fined them and let them stay on in the series for the year. They wouldn't have been thrown out, maybe. But the fact that they got away with it all year, and there was no, you couldn't tell when they had brought it in. So it had to be worked, let's say, under the assumption that they'd been running with it all year. So I would say that they were doing it to make an example of them, more so than that.
Yeah.
That they wouldn't do it again. And it kind of, I wonder, you know, the rankle as well, where people never really quite trusted them. Maybe again, you'd often hear the stories, like even people still joke about it now, when we used to see, I don't know, like Chris Meek could put in an unbelievable time on one of the power stages, I think last year. And the first thing everyone said, oh yeah, he's got the Sadiqa turbo in. It became the thing to say if, you know, the Toyota really put in a strong performance anywhere, because it just, people just associated it. And I think for, I suppose, Japanese culture, they really don't, they don't take well to that kind of thing either.
No, absolutely not. Like, that's why I'm so surprised they actually did it. Like, I know, you know, Toyota at the time were a massively successful team. So they dominated the early 90s, really. They'd taken over the mantle from Lancia as the team to beat in the sport. And they're obviously having issues with the 205. Again, this is kind of I know Uwe Andersson was never happy with having to use the Celica. There was obviously marketing driven reasons for that. He always wanted to use the Corolla. He eventually got his wish in the WRC Carrera. But, you know, maybe this car was almost forced upon them. And the 185 was a bit of a peak when it came out first, but it turned into a very competitive car. So, you know, maybe they couldn't be seen to leave the side down almost, and this was the only way. But it was so blatant. There was some, I'd love to have a proper look at one of them, because apparently the engineering design and finish that went into them is just unbelievable. Like, does, and that's probably why the FIA, you know, made such an example of them, was because it was so deliberate. There was no way you could ever say that, oh fuck, that was a manufacturing defect, or something's a bit out of tolerance, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? it was nothing like that. It was a system designed to circumvent the rules in the most efficient way possible and in the most cunning way possible. I think, to be honest, I don't think they got enough of a hammering. Do you know, they brought the sport, that's bringing world motorsport into disrepute. You saw what Benetton were at in 1994 in Formula One. Again, there was some fucking crazy stuff going on there. I don't think that kind of stuff, while, yeah, you'll always run to the margin of the regulations, you know, and they'll interpret stuff. Okay, well, it's not explicitly said that we can't do that. So, you know, you'd always have that. That's fine. That's the nature of things. But to go and actively tear up a regulation in the fashion they did was really bad.
I think that reputation almost is, it followed them to when they left the World Rally Championship to Formula One, because they were pushing the limits of the testing schedule in, I think it was 2001 was the year where they were testing all year, and then they came in and raced in 2002. And there was, you know, obviously the Formula One and the environment that it is, you know, it's a very cutthroat environment. I think it's often referred to as the Piranha Club, but they, I suppose Toyota could look at it as a degree of flattery that they were under a lot of scrutiny before they went in. But obviously the level of scrutiny from their competitors when Toyota went to Formula One, they were more than aware of what Toyota had done in their previous time, because it was only 5 years, that's it, 5-6 years.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have to imagine it was a little bit of a hangover from it. And, you know, who you really feel sorry for in all this is that there's probably a lot of guys there who had little to no knowledge of this going on whatsoever.
Yeah. No, definitely. Like, and, you know, you hear the stories about the engine room and the engine department being there, being like super difficult to get into. You know, some of the management didn't even know it was going to have a key in some cases. Yeah. So, you know, again, look, it's one of those things. It's gone down in the history of motorsport as a very infamous, you know, it's something that transcends the enthusiast side of the sport. It's something that, you know, a lot of people will probably have heard of, even if they're not into rallying. You know, it's the first thing I hear and I think of whenever I see an ST205, and I was like, oh yeah, fucking cheating bastards. But anyway,
It's not a sportsmanlike way to win the rally.
No. Yes, they've been disqualified.
Yes, they've been disqualified.
But anyway,
you had Häkkinen leading the rally. No need for that.
That's one thing. Yeah,
that had to have stuck out like a sore thumb. Like,
you had a man who would, you know, quite openly say himself that he hated tarmac. Do you know what I mean? He wasn't exactly, you know, trying to hide it. He's hatred for it. And all of a sudden, he's there leading, and the fucking Celica is leaving four black lines on the road out of every tight corner. Like, you know. Yeah.
Like, to be fair, you look at the footage and you're kind of saying that a little bit of me felt sorry for Kankin. He looked genuinely upset at the end of the rally. Well, sorry, at the end of his rally, at what had gone on. Because, okay, we have to work under the assumption, look, that Nicky Grist did the fantastic interview with Chris Harris there previously. Thanks, Chris. And they say they don't know that they knew nothing about it. Look, we can only take them at their word. And for someone who, like you say, little to no form had been shown previously on tarmac, to suddenly be going out there annihilating Carlos Sainz on home ground. And McRae was close enough, you know, to Sainz on pace. He was getting there. Not Aaron Schwartz, but Auriol was struggling, and he was getting frustrated. Why could he not get on the pace? Now, I imagine that was on Auriol's car as well. So, Juha Kankinen still had to drive the car.
Yeah.
So, like, I'd have a small bit of sympathy for Juha Kankinen in this instant, but at the end of the day, the rules weren't broken. They were just hit with a hammer. They were just made shit of that.
One thing that was mentioned around the time when M-Sport brought into focus in 99 and they got it was an anomaly with a water pump, non-homologated water pump, I think. And a water pump now is something that's not going to win or lose a rally, I feel like. It's just something you need to basically keep the engine in a functioning state and not a fucking melty mess. But
to keep it out of a Nissan GTIR mess, basically.
Yeah. Stop the fucking needle bending itself around the edge of the stop. But the one thing that kind of rankled with Ford, I remember reading, was that Toyota were one of the teams that protested about this water pump. And, you know, that kind of left a bit of a sour taste. Like, you know, hang on a second. Well, you're giving out about it possibly, you know, quite a genuine mistake. Whenever, because that Focus was quite rushed to get it in on time for 99, and there was even talks that the Escort was going to have to start 1999 at the time, but
they didn't have enough Focuses built at the time, because Petter Solberg was the junior driver in the team, and in Sweden he participated in, I think it was the car that Juha Kankinen had finished second in the RAC in, because they didn't have enough Focuses to do the rally. Yeah.
Frank Maher later bought that car. After that, yeah. But it was a bit of a kind of a kick in the teeth for Ford to see Toyota doing that. But anyway, the other aspect in the other major talking point in Catalonia, the team orders. As annoyed and odd as McRae was, I absolutely can see David Richards' point. I do, you know, the end of the day, Subaru was still a young team back then. You know, they hadn't won a championship at that point. They'd had a few wins or whatever, but they were, you know, in contention for the championship this year. Two brilliant drivers. Second last round of the championship. I can absolutely see why DR made the call to try and tell the lads the whole station. I think he was probably right even to do it. What do you reckon?
Like, if you look at the positions at the end of day two, there was 8 seconds between Sainz and McRae. Didier Auriol was 52 seconds behind. There is the argument that, you know, okay, Auriol could be getting the car finally to his liking now for day three, and we need to keep the push on to stop this guy behind us. But, yeah, it's a tricky one, because Subaru, in order to look, I suppose, to keep the people who paid the bills happy in Japan, they needed that championship. But ultimately, there was probably a bit of face saving for Sainz there. The McRae thing I find strange, because there's an interview with him where he says, "Yeah, it looks like we're going to hold station, you know, for day three," and then he goes out and does completely the opposite. Now, look, a bit of you kind of would say to yourself, that's, you know, look, you admire that kind of rebelliousness, but, you know, I don't think it did them any favors in terms of public relations either to have the debacle that unfolded on the streets of Lloret de Mar, you know, at the final control, you know, that was no good either.
Yeah.
You know, 8 seconds was probably still too fine a margin though for them to be at like that going into the final day anyway, you know?
Yeah. No, it was going
like
to be...
possibly maybe if Colin had clocked in 2 minutes later that evening, that would have, you know, enabled, you know, to be 28 seconds behind Carlos. Yeah. You know, that was a more manageable distance, you know, for day three.
Yeah.
Then again, it could bring him into play with Auriol. They weren't to know that Auriol's car was as bent as a banana.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, again, look, you know, all this stuff, and Mark mentioned it, you know, this was, he found that it was unusual. You know, he'd been covering the year to that point, and, you know, he initially thought that this was just part of the game, you know, the team order side, and, you know, but it was big news, you know, it wasn't the usual thing to happen, and a lot more prevalent than F1 and stuff, but, you know, you did see it in rallying in subsequent years again.
It's more common with Lancia, really, you know, like,
yeah,
teams like that where they had infinite amount of specialists that they brought in, you know, to manage the result.
Like, yeah. the most blatant demonstration of it was probably San Remo in 1986. I think we might do an episode on that in the future. That was a really, really messy event for the sport. A lot of really, really shit stuff happened there. But there's one very visual demonstration of it where I think Mickey Biazion and Dario Cerato, who's not even part of the Martini team, are basically crawling along the stage in order for Alain to come on and pass them out.
Yeah.
You know the piece of footage I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know the piece of footage you're on about. Yeah.
And that was after the Peugeots got excluded because of some fucking jacked up protest by Lancia around the sills and the cars being aerodynamic skirts and all this sort of mad stuff. The whole rally got cancelled, or the results got annulled in the end because it was so fucking crazy. But that's maybe something we'll do in the future. But anyway,
I suppose to put a bit of context on McRae and kind of, you know, his reaction, like, I suppose he was a young driver, you know, looking to, you know, stamp his authority. Like, he'd won, like, the year before, he'd won, I think he won two or three rallies in 94. Like, the second half of the year, he'd won Rally GB, sorry, the RAC, and he'd won New Zealand, did the same this year. And, you know, he was always on the podium. Like, you can understand someone's frustration like that as well. But, you know, it's a team game, you know, and it does come around to you as well. You know, if you do play the team game a lot of the time. But, you know, it's easy to look back and romanticize about it, you know, like, oh, yeah, Colin did the right thing. You know, Colin, you know, he really stuck it to them, but, you know, he had to take the hit. You know, ultimately, it's big business. You know, rallying, you know, as much of a sport as it is, the bills have to be paid and you're there to represent a manufacturer. And it's not nice to see team orders, but, you know, they've always been there.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're just not as apparent as what we've seen, what we saw here, but still. But yeah. Yeah. So that kind of.
Poor Bin is who I really felt sorry for.
Oh, the Bin got an awful load.
The Bin got an awful bit.
Inanimate object. Didn't, yeah. Didn't deserve that. But sure enough. That's how it ended up. I wonder where that Bin is now.
I don't know. It's probably.
It's probably worth a few pounds, the Bin. If you could. You know, that was the Bin that was kicked by McRae.
I'd say it got kicked a few more times the following year by McRae. That could be the other side of it.
Yeah, 96 was a bad old year for McRae, actually, after the highs in 95. And anyway, yeah, so we're not going to tell you what happened in GB because you probably all know already. And as we mentioned previously, the Absolute Rally Boys, Tony Simpson and the lads have done a couple of brilliant special episodes on those. So please go check that out. We're aspiring to be at the level of Absolute Rally someday, but we've got a long, long way to go yet, so big shout out to the lads there. Also, check out the Top Gear special. Chris Harris did a fucking fantastic segment on the 95 season where he actually drove L555 BAT as well, McRae's championship winning car, as part of it. Takes you through the whole kind of story and just a really, really nice piece.
There's also a feature in that episode on the Toyota cheat. So it's actually visually displayed what they did as well. So that's actually fantastic.
That's very good. Got to give a shout out to a couple of people as well before we finish up. Thanks again, Mark James, for joining us for this episode. Mark's a gentleman, and we'll be having him on again in the future. One of the voices, the most iconic voices of rally coverage of the 20th and 21st century. So shout out to Mark again for that. We also have to give a shout out to a couple of people who've subscribed to us from the likes of America and places like that. I know we get messages there on Instagram and things like that. So it's just lovely to see.
Does that mean we've sofas to keep on if we decide to go over there for a session?
I don't know. They might. Sure, who knows? Who knows? We won't forget a number for a while anyway, this fucking virus. But sure, look, hopefully in the future. But it's great to see. We love seeing people get in contact with us. Share their own stories, and you know,
there's been some lovely interactions as well on Twitter. It's been nice to see some of the people who've competed against some of the people we featured in some of the pods in the last season. They've come out of the work and telling their own stories. You know, it's been lovely to kind of see that, and you know, it's, you know, it kind of adds to the flavor of everything. And
again, look, thanks to all. We really enjoy hearing from people, and it's great to see people tuning in and stuff like that. So so that wraps us up for this episode. We'll be back for episode 4 of series 2 with another special episode. Can't reveal too much yet, half because it's kind of, we're not really sure ourselves who we're going to have on just yet. We've got a few.
It's not done.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah, this series is a small bit haphazard compared to series 1 in terms of how we're structuring it. But
we've actually got, you know, real work to do in the meantime. Like, we can't, you know, commit ourselves 24/7 to this like we were during lockdown.
Were we?
Well, no.
An hour a week. That's all it gets.
We had a good run in on that hour, though. That was the thing. We had a good couple of hours off before that hour started.
We're going to this fight now where we're doing research for the episode during the episode. Some fellas are texting 2 minutes before we're due to record that they forgot about it. I think what's his name again? Starts with W, ends with Ilium Nolan. No, that's too obvious. Let's just call him William Main.
William.
No. William. Yeah, he's a fucking Wilhelm, right? Wilhelm. Anyway, so thanks again for tuning in this week, and we will speak to you soon. Bye bye.